They'll beat you with their brains. Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to, we're not on Baseball Central. I guess we can just continue. Well, I'm going to say it's writer's block, but we're going to continue the discussion that Barker and Rex Hudler had with me Baseball Central about boning and spawning and crappies. Now,
crappies, yeah.
I've got Mr. Brunt with me, who is if I was to put together a media all-star fishing team.
Mm-hmm.
And put yourself in there, because you are known in the industry
I fish more than just about anybody. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so give me your murderer's row media fishing teams.
Well, Zeiss is a big fisherman.
Yeah.
Yeah, Zeiss is a huge fisherman. Who else is that? I'm trying to think if there's any.
You can go with other stations. Buck's
an offshore guy. Naylor and I used to fish at Super Bowl every year.
Okay.
Because we didn't golf.
But Buck's an offshore guy.
Buck's an offshore guy. He had a big boat, so he'd go off and fish the wrecks and stuff in Florida. Gotta think now. A lot of guys around a ball club, that's kind of a common thing.
I mean, I know that
a lot of ball players. Are
Justin
fishermen.
Smoke's a big fisherman.
Smokey was a big fisherman. Yeah, he was catching when they were living at Innisbrook. He was fishing in the golf course. Bass pond there. I fished that golf course too. I went out there. I was dodging golf balls because somebody told me there were some tarpon in one of the ponds.
That's still my favorite story.
This is just golf balls going by my head.
Did you live up to the dress code though? Did you have to wear shorts and golf pants?
I did not wear a white belt. But yeah,
what's that man doing there? Oh, he's just fishing. Don't
Gibby
worry.
Loved it. Actually, I fished with Gibby.
Okay.
Gibby's a good, he's very good company. I'm not sure he's that committed a fisherman, but he's excellent company as you go.
Yeah,
exactly. So you go out, 2 or 3 hours on a boat with Gibby's pretty good.
All right, well, that's a good start.
There's a lot of ball players, though. Like, they're all bass fishermen. You know, like Roy Halladay was a crazy fisherman.
Bass fisherman. Yeah. Got the boat, the rig, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So crappies, do you know from crappies?
Yeah, they're like sunfish, right? They're little. They're like a sunfish or a bluegill.
But the sunfish are the ones you used to catch and slam against the dock. Right?
That's what the crappies look. They don't look like that, but they're exactly the same shape. They're panfish. And they're tiny. Like, it's not a...
Is there
any
meat on them, or is it just the bones?
I think it would be a lot of work. I heard him talking about eating, if you get like 12 of them, which I'm sure is true, but it seemed like a lot of work. And the fishing he described seemed not all that sporting. It seemed like a lot of lines.
It's a little bit of the hillbilly hand fishing, right, that you used to see in TV, where the dudes wade into the water and like they basically wrestle. Something with gills and 17
eyes. That's catfish.
Eyes.
Yeah, it's a catfish.
Yeah,
thing.
Catfish.
Yeah. Noodling for them. Yeah, that's not, we don't call that fishing. But yeah, I was trying to figure out, I was listening to the segment. I have no idea what he was describing. We need to get him back on to describe it. But that's not the kind of stuff, that would not be my kind of fishing.
Well, as I said, it sounds like you're throwing a hand grenade into school of fish and just kind of running with a bucket.
Well, a lot of lines. But trout season here opens 1 week from Saturday.
There you go.
And it is socially responsible and socially distant. So
And you've got your...
I got my spot.
You got your spot.
I'll be there by myself, not infecting anybody.
When you go fishing by yourself,
yeah,
take a cigar.
No,
or are you more just?
I generally don't. I will smoke a cigar if I'm out on a trip somewhere, which I've only been canceling trips lately. But if I were out on a trip somewhere, at the end of the day, I would. I know some guys who can who smoke and fish at the same time. And some guys who are really like, I'm a fly fisherman, right? So there's a fair bit involved.
Yeah,
but I know guys who can cast like a fly rod and smoke a cigar at the same time and. Yeah, I generally don't, but afterwards, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because
I look forward to it.
Reminds me, I've told you my Jim Leland story, right? Yeah, about the most remarkable thing ever, Jim Leland smoking a cigarette and eating a steak in his uniform and doing an interview at the same time.
Yeah, I always...
That was the most
my
amazing.
My vision of Jim Leland is always like a guy smoking covered with, nicotine patches, right? Like Krusty, the Clown, right?
He did. He missed a game, and they found out because he was putting the patch on before the game.
Yeah.
But he was still sneaking out for a heater during the game with a patch on, which I guess you can't do.
It's not recommended. At the end of the day, the same thing. I don't drink when I fish. I can't do that, so I wouldn't even have a beer because I require all my faculties. But afterwards. But boy,
trickiest fish, smartest fish.
Well,
fish would give you the biggest.
Some are technically just. They're all technically. If you're a fly fisherman, again, there's a lot of different things. Like Atlantic salmoner. Don't eat when they're in freshwater, so you're trying to entice them into a reaction, not a feeding reaction. Bonefish down in the flats, in the South, you know, you're throwing a lot of line and you got to be precise. A lot of stuff you got to be kind of
you
precise.
You like bone fishing, don't you?
It's fantastic. Well, because you're also doing it in like spectacular places, right? If you're walking around and wading through 18 inches of water in the Bahamas on a white sand flat, that's doesn't matter if there's any fish or not.
That's true.
So, yeah. So, yes, things that trips that have been canceled over the last 12 months. There's a couple. So trout fishing in Ontario. Always a ritual since going back to when I was a little kid with my dad, and often was cold enough there'd be snow in the woods still when you went out. It's going to be pretty brisk this weekend, but I don't think we'll have any snow.
I just remember that I was out for a walk in Coots Paradise. Folks who know the Hamilton area, this might have been 3 years after we moved there. I was out for a walk with my daughter. I had no idea there was salmon.
Yeah, they're the Pacific salmon that had been stocked in a lake.
And they were spawning, and And I remember looking at it, and there was a couple of other people with us. And I said, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
The guy says, salmon. I said, yeah, right.
Well,
said,
yeah, no, there's big runs around here, like in the Credit and the Brawny Creek. And, there's Chinook that were stocked and some coho specific ones. And then there's rainbow trout that are stocked that run up, steelhead that run up those rivers. And, Coots Paradise, where we live, has got all kinds of mysterious stuff in it. So it's full of fish. It's actually really alive and amazing. I was down there yesterday. It's spectacular.
But there is the odd blinky, the three-eyed fish pops up every now and then.
There's been some issues. It's better. It's a lot better than it was when I was a kid, I'll tell you that.
All right, let's move on. I mean, I could talk about it all day because I just found the whole thing with Rex. First of all, I have no idea where Barker pulled the question out from.
No,
he's not telling me.
I was listening and I thought, boy, you had insider. He had inside information because he's not a fisherman.
No, Barker. He's a hunter. Yes.
So we often, we cross over a little bit on things, but he's not really a fisherman. Okay. I was impressed.
Okay. Anyhow, so there we learned a little bit about spawning crappies.
Yes.
Today. We also learned a lot about the Royals from Rex Hudler, who gave a 7-minute answer to one question, which is good because normally I'm asking 7-minute questions and getting 1-minute answers.
It was pretty great.
That was good. Let's get to I want to deal with the serious stuff. This Vancouver Canucks story is, I don't even know how to describe it. We've all seen the JT Miller interview yesterday, which in and of itself was, to me, it was remarkable because of how matter of fact. I don't know if I've seen an interview from an athlete throughout this, and I have not seen all of them.
Yeah.
I know that Eduardo Rodriguez did one with the Red Sox, and it was translated, and he was pretty emotional. He had a serious issue with COVID-19. I don't know if I've ever had an interview where I've kind of just crossed my arms, sat back, listened to it, and gone, yeah.
Well, me too. Like it's that point of frustration and fatigue and what the hell, what are we doing this for kind of stuff that I think, in different circumstances, a lot of people have kind of hit that particular wall.
We can't wrap our head around, and I'm saying it myself, I can't wrap my head around the idea that this could really harm a professional athlete. I don't know why. I understand it's completely stupid to think that way, but.
Well, it's changed though too, right? Like there has been a pivot here. And
I know.
I think that's significant. It's one thing to have somebody tell you you're positive in a test and then go away and live essentially a normal life for a few days and come back and then they tell you you're negative on a test, then you go about your business. For a disease that, at the beginning was affected mostly, in its kind of really serious effects was mostly limited to old people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different if people actually get sick, if they have symptoms, if they're frightened, we've talked about that all along here that it would be a turning point. And you're right about Eduardo Rodriguez. Cause he had a heart issue that
heart
spun
issue.
Out from it. Right.
Yeah.
But I think there's a bunch of things going on, I think that has changed, who it's affecting. I think people actually getting sick, who are younger, that's front of mind, and family and kids. And, also there's just, there's more of a, less of a sense of we got to get to the end of this, we got to fight through, and more a sense of kind of looking at it and saying, when is the end of this and why are we fighting through and what's the point? In terms of the Canucks, I know they all say they want to play and continue their season, but this is not like kind of be everybody in the bubble. Okay, we're going to get through this. We're just going to get through this one time. And now it's almost a year later, right? And their season's basically, they're done anyway. and they have contractual obligations, and the league wants them to play, the TV network wants them to play, and their union wants them to play. Yeah. But they're probably, you know, again, if you worry, just think of the human dynamic. You're sitting there thinking, okay, you know, this has crept into a whole bunch of nooks and crannies on this team, including some families. We're not going anywhere. They want us right back on the ice as fast as possible. You know, the minute we're green lit, day later we're going to play. And I know other teams have done that. Like, there are other, you know, that's what the Habs did, right? Once they're all, you know. But I get it. And I think, you know, in one sense, I don't know what it's like to be a professional athlete. And I have less of an idea what it's like to be a professional athlete in these circumstances. But that feeling of kind of, you know what, I'm done. And I'm not sure why, you know, what the point of this is. I think all of us on some level
have kind of,
we relate to that. Yeah.
The Canucks are practicing today. They've closed their practice to the media. That was done at the last minute. They are scheduled, at least according to the NHL Players Association, they're scheduled to be a discussion today with medical groups from the league and the Players Association. The Canucks right now are scheduled to play 19 games in 30 days. Another little bit of a wrench has been thrown into this with this chatter about stopping interprovincial travel, which is a completely different story. I'm sure the NHL will get some sort of dispensation for this, but thank you, Derek. Elliot Friedman just tweeting that tomorrow's Canucks game has been postponed.
There you go. That's the beginning of something. I mean, there's still a lot to work out.
Yeah. 21 players, 4 members of the coaching staff have tested positive for the virus since March 30th. They've not played since March 24th. Have they all tested for a virus variant? I know there were some virus variants involved in that.
Yeah, well, the P1, the Brazilian one, is a big problem in BC right now. So there's so
I should really say that. As of yesterday, there were 7 Canucks on the NHL's COVID-19 list. And I know there's a lot of reaction in social media, people saying, well, where's the NHLPA in this? Where's Donald Fehr in all this? And the thing you need to keep in mind here, and I'm not going to carry water for the NHL Players Association here, but Brent, you made the point, you know, the Players Association wants the Canucks to play. The networks want the Canucks to play. This was all collectively bargained.
Correct.
This was all negotiated. There are protocols in place. And yes, and this sucks because I know that you're saying, Jeff, screw your protocols. You've got 21 people sick here. But, and I can't believe I'm saying, at this point, you kind of have to trust the NHL's process.
Yeah.
Because it was an agreed to process. And if you don't trust it in this case, you don't know what is going to happen down the road. And that is an issue here.
Mm-hmm.
That is an issue here. If this was something where you could say, okay, this is the only time it's going to happen, then maybe you deal with it one way. But we just don't know. And if you do one thing for one team, you've got to do it for the other team. And I'm with all of you out there. Like, if it's up to me, the Vancouver Canucks don't play another game until their players are ready to get in the ice. And you know what? If that means they only play 2 more games or no games or 15 games or 12 games, that's fine. But I'm just saying you have to understand that there are protocols and a process in place here. And sometimes people roll their eyes when you say there's a process in place, but there's a reason that process.
Well, and that's, you know, we lauded these guys for getting back on the ice,
sure.
Right? And for the, you know, relative, you know, getting back on the ice, figuring out a collective agreement in the middle of a pandemic, managing to conclude last season, managing to agree to have a representative season this year, existing outside of bubbles, mostly without issues, although some issues, you're not going to have no issues. It's in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that is, all of that is a result of the process you're alluding to. Right?
I wonder if we're not going to go back to a bubble situation here to get this thing done, at least in the Canadian.
They may have to do it in Canada. Like, not going to do it in the state. Here's the great irony. Yeah. But they may well have to play those 2 rounds in a bubble in Canada.
I was thinking about
honestly,
it last
Jeff,
night.
I kind of think, why not?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. It's not going to have an impact on your TV, on your network contract.
No.
It's actually, I would say probably theoretically, because you're not going to be traveling, it would make things a little easier for the players, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're doing away with home ice advantage, but I mean, you know, it doesn't matter when there's nobody in the stands. I really wonder if we're not in a position where we see that And then it gets interesting because you're right. There's really no reason for American teams to go into a bubble at this point.
No, plus they have the option of getting their players vaccinated.
They have the option of getting their players vaccinated.
So I would think here for two rounds, yeah, I would do it. I guarantee you they're talking about it. It just makes sense to me. You know, it makes sense. I'm not sure what, aside from, 3 weeks of, further inconvenience for the players. They're not going to enjoy it. And some added costs in terms of setting it up. The certainty that you get with it, I would say that, yeah, it makes, whether you do it in Edmonton, you do it in Toronto, you only need one site.
Yep. Ren LeVar, NHL insider with TVS Sports, will join us at 4 o'clock. We'll see if Ren has any more news on that. Bev Priestman, head coach of the Canadian women's national soccer team at 3:40. Two big wins, beating Wales 3-0 on Friday and England 2-0 on Tuesday for Bev Priestman. You'd want to talk about hitting the ground running.
Yeah. They do not have a game scheduled between now and Tokyo.
If Tokyo happens. And
wow.
Yeah.
That's a long haul with no, you know, with nothing. Again, I'm not even sure how long what kind of a camp they're going to be able to have.
They'll be rested if nothing else.
Yeah.
Jeff Passan joins us at 4:25.
His beloved Kansas City Royals this week, his favorite team.
Royals.
He loves them. He's so excited about that.
He's a Kansas City dude.
He is. Well, yeah, that's his
home.
From
Cleveland originally.
Yeah, but that's his, he decided to be dead center in the middle of the country. It's a good place right now. They are a fun team. I'm looking forward to this
series. I am too. I've been kind of, purely by fluke, I watched three Kansas City Royals games during Cactus League, and just Bobby Witt Jr. is like the greatest thing not named Bo Bichette, and now he's not with the team.
No,
but they're a fun team. This will be the array of talent on the field for this series will be really good.
Yeah, this
it's
is
gonna
the,
be a lot
the 2024 of fun. American League Championship Series preview.
I would say you're probably not that far away because Kansas City is, and they are much like the Blue Jays. They've got players coming up at different levels. They may be a little ahead of the Blue Jays in terms of pitching, but and they've got their general manager Dayton Moore is just one of the smartest guys in baseball. Anyhow, so we'll be joined by Jeff Passan.
We were talking about that when I was last here. We were in the midst of that Yankee series, and we were talking about the Yankees perhaps not being quite as fearsome as we imagined.
I'll
tell you, man, Tyone and Kluber. Like I know Tyone's still in theory kind of working his way back, and so is Kluber, I guess, sort of still working his way back. But I'll tell you something, Jeff. If that's their 2-3 right now,
they're not going to win the division.
Not with that, they're not.
Nope, they're not. I'm sorry. I am absolutely convinced. And I don't think that. Frankly, I think there are parts of that lineup that's pretty easy to pitch to right now as well.
It has less that feel of Murderer's Row that you kind of thought, oh, there, you're not going to get a second's rest with that lineup.
You never know who's going to play. And I keep getting back to this. The thing about those great Yankees teams is they always played. You knew Jeter was in the lineup. You knew Posada was in the lineup, right? You knew they were there. Robbie Cano was in the lineup every day. Paul O'Neill in the lineup every day. Tino in the lineup every day. And the Yankees don't have that.
Yeah. And the Jays, Judge had his two Judge shots, right? Like the line drives that go out of parks. Like but you can pitch to Stanton. Jays did a reasonable job on LeMahieu. Mm-hmm. Again, I think over the course of time, LeMahieu will be LeMahieu.
Torres is a mess.
Yeah, he.
I don't know.
Torres is a mess.
There.
And I just thought, there's some flaws in this lineup that I probably wouldn't have acknowledged going in. But the big one is those, I think their bullpen's still really good. But, and obviously they got the closer of all time.
Right. I don't say breaking news. A couple of newsy items. One, this will be a big deal for me because I am a Grand Prix fan. The Canadian Grand Prix has
been canceled.
Canceled for the second year in a row, which is bad. I mean, I wouldn't have gone there anyhow, but anyhow. And Austin Matthews is out tonight. He's day-to-day with that
arm thing.
That hand-wrist thing. So we talked about Major League Baseball bringing a bunch of things in the minor leagues this year. They're experimenting with a bunch of different rules, pace of play rules, things of that nature. The Atlantic League and Major League Baseball announced yesterday that they are going to, and it's an independent league, they are using a number of experimental rules this year, including the double hook DH rule, which I think is something Jason Stark dreamed up. And the last time a writer dreamed up something that stuck in the game was when John Lowe of the Detroit Free Press coined the quality game, which
I didn't know Lowe invented that.
John Lowe invented the quality. God's honest truth.
Oh, God,
John Lowe invented the quality game. Anyhow, yeah. So I don't know if this is called the Stark. It's the double hook DH rule, which only allows the team to use the DH as long as their starting pitcher remains in the game. That's kind of cool. They're also talking about moving the pitching rubber back a full foot to 61 feet, 6 inches for the second half of the season. So they're going to be doing a lot of experimenting. Morgan Sword is executive VP of baseball operations with Major League Baseball. He's a guy that oversees all this. He'll join us next. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Right, welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Blue Jays baseball tonight, 8 o'clock, Kansas City and the Toronto Blue Jays, 7 o'clock pregame on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Of course, you can only watch the game on Sportsnet and hear it on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. 7:30 p.m., Blue Jays Central on Sportsnet as the Jays open a four-game series against the Kansas City Royals, coming off their second consecutive series win over the New York Yankees, or their second series win over the New York Yankees with Bo Bichette walking it off. So we've talked a lot all year about some of the various things we're seeing Major League Baseball do surrounding pace of play. And we talked last year about how the pandemic had kind of created an environment where a lot of things were on the table. Some of the things were on the table because it was necessary in order to play the 60-game schedule, to get it fit in time so you could have a postseason, you know, expanded playoffs, things of this nature. There's a lot going on right now. Pace of play rules very much going to be experimented with in the minor leagues. These two rules that we're going to talk about today really intrigue me. I'm old enough that I can remember when the pitching mound was raised and lowered.
Yeah.
Well, I'm old enough when I...
lowered to get to you because of... essentially because of Bob Gibson.
Bob Gibson, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I'm old enough that I can remember that. I mean, I'm old enough. I've been through everything, DH, all the realignment, all that good stuff. But this in particular intrigues me. Major League Baseball and the Atlantic League, which is an independent league, announced yesterday a couple of rules changes. One, the double hook DH rule, which is only going to allow teams to use the DH as long as their starting pitcher remains in the game, which I think is intriguing because it adds a whole new strategic element to the game, which I'm really in favor of. And moving back the pitching rubber a full foot to 61 feet, 6 inches for the second half of the season. I will admit that when I first heard that, I thought, oh God, this is like stop, you know, put the crayons away. But I don't know.
I have no idea what it'd do. I'm not saying, I honestly don't know. How long has the pitching rubber been at 60'6"?
This is something, quite frankly, of all the things they're talking about, this is the one that I am most intrigued with. Morgan Sword is executive VP of baseball operations with Major League Baseball. He joins us on Writer's Block. Morgan, thank you so much for your patience. I really appreciate it. Look, you guys are doing a lot of things. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of the idea of moving the pitching rubber back a full foot and sort of who was involved in it and what it, again, understanding this is kind of theoretical right now, what it will accomplish.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. And happy Jackie Robinson Day.
Yes, you too, Morgan.
Same to you.
So, you know, this has been an interesting process for us. We have a group internally that focuses on these issues, right? They're kind of the way the game looks on the field and what's going on, you know, in the competition. And we've been lucky enough to have Theo Epstein join that group, you know, in the last couple of months. And, you know, we've gone through a pretty extensive process of talking to, you know, our big league managers, a lot of major league players, you know, about, you know, what they're seeing on the field and you know, trying to be as creative as we can while maintaining the soul of baseball, you know, that everybody loves. And one of the things that we want to try to address is strikeouts. You know, we're at the moment right or hovering around 25% of our plate appearances this season have ended in strikeouts, which is an all-time high in the history of baseball. And, you know, it's something that, you know, when you ask fans, you know, they don't want to see that many strikeouts in a baseball game. And it leads to, you know, less action than probably we'd ultimately like. So, you know, we've been on the hunt for ways to reduce our strikeout rate that, you know, would not be too disruptive to the game, but would kind of nudge us in the right direction. And this is the one that keeps coming back to the top of the list. And, there, you know, there's a lot of different opinions about this one. I'm very interested to see how it goes. And you know, what we keep coming back to, though, is the only way you're going to know is if you try it and you know, see what happens.
Jeff, my co-host here alluded to in the lead up, alluded to lowering the mound in the 60s, which, you know, which changed in an era of dominant pitching. I was going to say, Morgan, how long has the 60-foot-6-inch, how long has that been the distance? Like, I was just trying to look it up here while you were speaking, and I haven't found it. But, is, you know, does that date – that's got to date back to, you know, the formative days of the sport, doesn't it?
Yes. I believe 1893 is the last time we moved the mound. Wow. And, you know, you hear all these wonderful stories about how we ended up at 60 feet, 6 inches in the first place, which is kind of a random number if you think about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the story I've been told, and I haven't been able to verify this, is that it's actually like a typo. It was supposed to be 60 feet, and somebody, you know, when they were handwriting the rules, kind of couldn't read the handwriting, and it ended up at 60 feet, 6 inches. So, and there we've been since 1893. So, but, you know, there's a belief among a lot of really smart baseball people that, you know, we have kind of outgrown the current dimensions of, you know, the distance of the pitching rubber to the plate. And, you know, when that distance was picked, nobody was throwing 99 miles an hour with unbelievable movement. And, you know, hitting was not as difficult as it is today.
You know, it's fascinating hearing you say that. First of all, because I had not thought of that. I mean, athletes are bigger than they were back when those rules were made, and other sports have had to deal with it. You know, hockey players are bigger than they used to be, and it's had an impact on the way the game has changed. My concern, though, is, Morgan, and I'm sure you had to address this. Boy, pitching, as someone who has covered baseball since '88 and seen more pitching injuries than he cares to remember. Any concern at all that there's added stress put on the arm by moving it back?
Yeah, it's a great question. And something that we have focused on a lot, you know, this has been kind of kicking around for a couple of years in our office. And we actually commissioned a study with the American Sports Medicine Institute, which is, you know, Dr. James Andrews and Glenn Fleissig and some of the preeminent kind of biomechanics experts in the world. On this exact issue, right? What's the effect on pitching health of moving the mound back? And we tested as far back as 63 feet just to kind of see. And you know, the result of that study, it's publicly available, but the result of that study was basically there, you know, that there is no impact on biomechanics if you're moving the mound in those kinds of increments. And, you know, one way to think about it is, you know, the pitcher's throwing to a catcher, right, who is further than 60 feet, 6 inches from him, right? Mm. And those catchers vary in how deep that they set up. And we actually have data on this. And, you know, there's about a foot or two of variance in just in the way the catcher set up, right? So even within a given game, you could be throwing some pitches 64 feet and some pitches 62 and a half feet. So we think that, you know, we are fairly limited in the injury risk, but it's something we've spent a lot of time thinking about because obviously that's kind of the number one priority with any of these tweaks is make sure that we're, you know, doing everything we can to manage health and safety appropriately.
Now, Morgan, we'll get to the double hook thing in a second, but I want to also ask you about the automatic ball and strike system, which most people think of as the robot umpire or the Hawkeye umpire.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, you're bringing it back in the Atlantic League again this year. I know it's been refined a little bit, but like how close are we to, you know, how close is baseball to having an automatic ball and strike system that it feels is workable?
We're closer. We're much closer than we were in 2019 when this thing got launched. You know, it's interesting. The technology piece of it has come along very quickly. You know, we're going to be running it on tracking systems that are remarkably accurate, and you know all of the steps in the process, the locating the pitch, determining whether it's a ball or a strike, and then producing the signal to the umpire has gone great. You know, the next hurdle for us collectively are the baseball questions, right? Like, what exactly do you want the strike zone to be? The two-dimensional or three-dimensional? What shape should the strike zone be? And should it vary based on batter height or stance? All of these questions that we need to answer in order to get it kind of ready for prime time. And that is really the focus of this season. You know, can we get to the point where this is really seamless, and it helps the umpire, it moves the game along, and it looks and feels as close as possible to what players are experiencing now.
Okay, now so the double hook rule. I guess first of all, explain it to the folks listening. And it does feel obviously like a kind of middle ground between the American League rules and the National League rules. You know, we've had a lot of talk about. There was a universal DH in the shortened season last year. It's something that'll be collectively bargained coming up. But this idea of a rule that is not fully one or the other, what are the advantages? What are the kind of strategic implications?
Sure, yeah. So as you said, it is a very interesting idea that I'm not even really sure the origins of it originally. But, it's something we've been talking about internally for a couple of years. Basically, the way the rule works is both teams start the game with the use of a designated hitter, and you get to keep it as long as your starting pitcher stays in the game. And then once you take your starter out, you basically play the National League game for the rest of the game. And as you mentioned, it's what I view as a pretty clever compromise between kind of going wholesale to a DH everywhere and not having a DH anywhere, where your starting pitcher is never hitting, right? You always have a DH. And then you get to play the National League game in the back half of the game which some fans view as kind of a more interesting game. There's more substitutions, pinch hitting, double switching, and has maybe an increased strategic element to it. The other thing we're interested to see is whether it fulfills the objective of keeping starting pitchers in the game longer. It's something we've seen at the big league level that, teams are pulling starting pitchers early and earlier in the game. And, that is not something that we like, honestly. We'd like to see starting pitchers have a more prominent role and carry a larger load for clubs. And, we're on the hunt for ways to do that. So, I know that the DH debate is as old as the DH rule itself. So, which form of baseball is better? And we're excited to see this one in action.
Yeah, and you wouldn't. I'm just thinking it through. You wouldn't have, but in practicality, you would almost never see pitchers hitting right in with the double hook. Like you wouldn't have those kind Correct. Of mandatory first two at bats right. from a starting pitcher. You would, maybe occasionally, but see a relief pitcher hit, but not very often.
No, totally. I agree. I grew up a Met fan. I grew up in New Jersey, and the Mets had a guy named Lenny Harris, who I'm sure you guys remember,
yes.
Who was, the quintessential kind of professional pinch hitter, right? That guy would, sit and get ready for 2.5 hours, and then he'd come up in the biggest spot every single night. And, you don't see as much of that, these days, and that type of player, carrying a role on a team. And, we won't know till we try it. We'll see what it looks like. We'll see how Atlantic League managers respond to that rule. But we're excited to see.
Morgan, last question before I let you run, and I do mean this respectfully. Is there something that won't be touched? Now, I'm saying leaving aside, maybe we go to four bases instead of three or whatever. But are there third rails for you guys when you look at the game?
Yeah, there are. I think they're different for everybody, and you guys probably have in your head, right? Like what is too much, right? Because there are rule changes that would meet our objectives that would be, but would also kind of sacrifice some of the soul of this game, right? Like, we could reduce strikeouts by, starting everybody with a 1-1 count, right?
Yep.
But that to most people we talk to feels like a third rail issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this has been like a very interesting exercise of, how do you identify the solutions to these issues and the rules that will nudge us toward a more interesting, exciting, action-packed game without offending the sensibilities of the millions and millions of baseball fans and, people that devote their lives to this game. So, we're not there yet. We don't know, but we think that between the affiliated system and some of these Atlantic League changes, you know, we're on the right track.
Morgan, really good of you to join us today. Terrific information. Thank you very much.
No problem, guys.
Take care. Absolutely. Morgan Sword is Executive Vice President of Baseball Operations with Major League Baseball. That was fascinating.
Yes.
It was a fascinating discussion.
Yeah, it really
is. And you know what? I got to tell you, I'm already sold on the double hook DH.
Yeah, I kind of I like it too. The wheels were turning as he was, I was
that's
listening
exactly
to him.
Exactly. I was looking at you and I'm going,
yeah, this would
because
be okay.
My initial reaction is, oh, really? But the more I think about it, you're right. It's what it's going to do is it's going to force, I would think it would force managers to leave starting pitchers in longer. That's really, but it doesn't mean that you're going to have seven pitchers hitting in a game.
No, I don't want to watch pitcher at bats.
No,
I'm sorry. I don't want to watch pitchers hit.
Or someplace Shohei Ohtani is saying, how much did I sign for?
Other than him.
How much did I sign for? Can I redo this contract? Bev Priestman is head coach of the Canadian national women's soccer team. They beat England 2-0 on Tuesday, beat Wales 3-0 on Friday. Now they wait for the Olympics along with the rest of us. 99 days from today, as a matter of fact, the opening ceremonies. Bev Priestman's next. This is Writer's Block. All right, welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. So, give you some updates in the Vancouver Canucks situation right now. Elliot Friedman has reported that tomorrow's Oilers-Canucks game is officially postponed. Our friend John Shannon is reporting that the Leafs are still slated to fly to Vancouver tomorrow for Saturday's game. So, the Canucks, of course, were in the position where they had returned to the ice today after 21 players had tested positive for COVID-19. And they were scheduled to practice today and play tomorrow against Edmonton. So, and of course, we talked at the start of the show, JT Miller, very outspoken about sort of what that meant for the team. It appears as if some sort of compromise has been reached. And I've got to think, Stephen, that what this means right now is it's just they're buying time.
Yeah.
Buying time to see what has happened.
It's yet another kind of impossible situation, right? Like, I understand from both sides here.
Oh, completely.
You know, like, I'm... And I wish I could say this is what they should do. I got no idea.
Okay. All right. Well, that's fine. Derek Brandeo explained that we are having difficulty getting Bev Priestman, head coach of the Canadian women's national soccer team. Technological issues. She's there. Technological issues. But Stephen, we can talk a little bit as we attempt to get Bev because we've talked about the Canadian women's soccer program, a program that you've covered longer than I have, but we both have a great deal of affection for it, not just the players, but the program itself. And Canada's women, they've competed in the She Believes Cup, and they got mixed results there. But in a couple of friendlies, they beat Wales 3-0 on Friday and England 2-0 on Tuesday. And England, very much a team they may have to go through in the Olympics in London to get a medal. England's kind of right in that area, 6th, 7th, 8th ranked in the world.
Yep.
They did it without Christine Sinclair.
Yes, they did.
They scored two goals without Christine Sinclair. One of them, they were kind of gifted the goal. It was funny. I rewatched that game, and in some ways, I wonder if maybe what we've seen with the women's program, Stephen, isn't the same thing as in the men's program. There are a lot of there are more offensively gifted Canadian soccer players now than there used to be. It's not just hoof the ball downfield and hope that you can out-muscle somebody and score in your one shot.
Yeah, I would, and again, I would say there are more offensively gifted players right now than there have been on some of those very fine teams that won Olympic medals. Like, and they look, and I, Lord knows I am taking nothing away from those teams, and especially from Christine, the great Christine Sinclair. But it's a different looking group now. They play the game a little differently, and I think they're benefiting. Some of the women are benefiting from playing in the European, the big European leagues in France, and
Becky and Ashley. Yeah. Ashley Lawrence is a terrific player.
So, I think we all kind of wondered what would happen after the golden generation passed, and Sink's really the only one of them left. I guess Sophie Schmidt's still around. She's been capped a ton. Yeah. And you know, Aaron McLeod's still theoretically around. Desiree Scott's still there.
Yeah.
But you know, that, you know, I think there was a feeling in a lot of circles that that was a once in a lifetime thing for Canada. It had all come together, and mm-hmm. you know, coming up behind them was big question mark. Well, I'm way more optimistic now than I was, I'll tell you, about what's coming.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the women's soccer, to me, has the WNBA gets a lot of gets a fair amount of play in North America. We can argue whether it doesn't get enough, but boy, I look around and the growth in the women's game, women's soccer, the quality of game, the pace of the game, the athletes of the game. It really is remarkable
it's
now.
It's changed more than any sport notch. I watch.
Without question.
I said the other day, you know, oh, let's get Bev on.
Okay, yep. We do. Bev Priestman joining us. Bev, thanks so much for your patience. We really, really appreciate this. We trust you're keeping well. Where are you right now? Are you still overseas?
No, I'm actually in Vancouver. I got back last night, so ready to settle now before the next camp.
Look, I've got to ask you, you know, Mr. Brunt made this point. Now we now wait for the Olympics along with you and other people. But my goodness, it's not as if this is the team that's been able to have a regular schedule in terms of competition. How impressed are you that, you know, this team could come together and, you know, be, I understand some of the players are already overseas, but come together and not just beat Wales 3-0, but then go on to beat England 2-0?
Yeah, I think what we've done is sort of just go after some real basic, simple behaviours. So I think when you don't have people together a lot, rather than, I guess, over-emphasising so much tactics and systems, and, you know, we've just tried to keep it really, really simple and maximise the strengths of the individuals. So we spent a lot of time on that. And then I guess when they're away from us, it's homing in on those behaviours to make sure that they're doing it every day in their training environment.
So, Bev, what, you know, I know that right as of now, I'm not sure you guys have a match scheduled between now and Tokyo. I'm guessing you'll try to find some friendlies in there. But, you know, with all of the uncertainty, not just about, you know, Tokyo, but about the world right now, what's, you know, how are you kind of sketching out the next few months in terms of, you know, when you'll be able to have a camp, you know, when the team will be able to assemble, how you find some competition between now and Tokyo, mm-hmm. and then how you deal with whatever Tokyo is going to be, because it's not going to be like every other Olympics in terms of, you know, going to the village and getting comfortable and spending a lot of time there. It sounds like it's going to be, they're going to want athletes to come in and out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I think on that last point there, that's how we've sort of had to operate now in both camps, you know, really strict COVID protocols, playing in stadiums with no fans, which is very different for all the players. And a lot of them are doing it now week in, week out with clubs. So I think we're preparing ourselves well for an Olympics that might look very, very different. So that works. I think now, between now and the Olympics, we will have a camp in June where we hope to have some games. We're just working through that at the moment. And then, you know, a preparation camp potentially early in Tokyo or, you know, en route somewhere. So we should hopefully before the Olympics get another 3 to 4 games in. That would be the plan.
Bev, Stephen and I were talking about this a little bit while we were attempting to get you. And, you know, I said, look, I'm old enough when I can remember watching the Canadian men play, and they played a certain style. And you'd never have a Canadian men's team with as much offensive talent that you have right now. It's the same thing with the women's team. You seem to have, there seems to be an abundance of creativity, an abundance of playmakers. Is that a product, do you think, of just the growth of the women's game in general, maybe the growth of training? Or what explains that exactly? Because, look, I try to follow women's soccer. I watch the Premier League matches on Saturday morning as much as I can and try to keep track of the Canadians. But it seems like I watch this team play and I go, man, I didn't realize she was that good, you know, to be honest. And I think I probably follow it more than a lot of people.
Yeah, I think it's probably two things. One, I think, you know, when John Herdman come in, there's an alignment in our system, or there has been, and, you know, identifying these players, they've had a lot put into them very young, which has been great. I think that's been a key to success in terms of, like, elevating players that are ready to be elevated regardless of their age. So that's one thing. And I think, secondly, the women's game is now more professional. and more technical, quicker. So if they're training in that environment every day, it's only going to make them better. So you look at the likes of Janine Becky at Manchester City, you know, surrounded by internationals day in, day out, and then the pressure of having to win every single weekend to stay at the top of the table. I think that only adds to, you know, what that player looks like. So I think it's both. I think the women's game's come a long way, the professionalism, the investment, the resources, the coaching. And then secondly, I think just us knowing and identifying the best players early and investing in them.
Bev, how was when Christine Sinclair went down with that ankle injury? It looked awful. Thank God it's not. I guess it's not quite as bad as it looked at the time. How's she doing? What's her timetable? And I guess more importantly, maybe even at this stage in her career, what does she mean to this side?
Yeah, I think. Well, yeah, I was gutted, to be honest, in terms of going down in that pain. I knew that basically she got kicked in a site that was the reason she was out for, she believes. So the good news is it was just, you know, inflammation, and it was really sore and couldn't turn that around and didn't want to take that risk, me personally, going into that England game as a one-off game. So I think Christine, you know, once that inflammation goes down, will be back on track and get a good NWSL season in before the Olympics. So, you know, it was gutted because I felt even for them 30 minutes that she was on the pitch, her quality just, you know, she keeps things ticking, that touch. You know, we talk about Christine scoring goals, but it's much, much more than that. And then secondly, I think this was the first time for me where I'd been in the environment where Christine was in, and just, you know, just her presence, her humility around the players. I think, you know, you've got very young players that have come in and been exposed. She just brings a level of, like, yeah, an aura, really, but a confidence. And I think that does great things for the group. And then lastly, I think the group's confidence to know that they can put the ball in the back of the net and we don't just have to rely on Christine. I think that will also potentially do her the world of good in terms of not carrying that on her shoulders either. So it was great to have her in, and just relieved that, you know, that kick just was, you know, it was what it was and nothing more serious.
Bev, we just have a minute left here. I did want to ask you about two other players, Kadisha Buchanan and Ashley Lawrence. Like, you know, I understand we focus on Christine a lot, but I know, for example, The Guardian listed Kadisha as the 36th ranked player in the world. There really is a depth. There's a depth at all ends of the pitch with this team, isn't there?
Yeah, well, Kadisha obviously haven't had in yet as a head coach, so I'm really excited to get Kadisha. I watch her games week in, week out, and, you know, she's really come along. So, yeah, excited to get Kadisha in. And then Ashley, I thought adding Ashley to that mix was a game changer. You know, being able to play fullback, midfield, our athleticism, our technical quality, that was fantastic to have Ashley in for the first time. So you add Kadisha to that, and, you know, it's going to be difficult to pick an 18-player roster. I mean, that's a good problem to have as a coach, but I feel that even more now than ever.
Bev, listen, we really appreciate you joining us again. Congratulations on those two results. Stay safe, and we look forward to chatting before Japan. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much.
Bev Priestman, head coach of the Canadian national women's team. And it is, as I said, there's some depth here that we haven't seen in some time. Ren Lavoie, TVS Sports NHL insider. Ren's next.
They're rewriting afternoon sports radio one word at a time. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Stephen Brunt on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
We'll be joined by Jeff Passan later on in the hour. It is Jackie Robinson Day in Major League Baseball. I'll talk to Mr. Passan about that. Major League Baseball remembering Jackie Robinson today. The game you watch, you'll see all the players wearing uniform number 42. You'll see a lot of patches. You'll see a lot of some of the special cleats. It's turned into a real, and I'm using air quotes here, it's turned into a real thing. Major League Baseball players. You got a lot of buy-in.
And, you know, not to go too far down that road right now, but there's I just read a great column by Bill Roden on The Undefeated, you know, the great Bill Roden.
Yes.
He's the columnist for the New York Times for a long time and one of my real idols in the biz, saying that this, on this Jackie Robinson Day, baseball actually kind of lived up to it. with what they did with the All-Star game.
Mm-hmm.
That Jackie Robinson, you know, again, who people forget that Jackie Robinson at the end of his life, that last All-Star game when he played,
right,
was you know, disheartened by the lack of progress, you know, in baseball and in the world. And baseball put its money where its mouth was.
Yeah. No,
you know, so it's not just about uniform patches today.
No, it really did. And again, you'll notice that. Today you watch the Jays in Kansas City. Tonight you'll see the players wearing number 42. And Kansas City kind of is a special place to be on this day because the Negro League Museum is in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. But also Kansas City's it's kind of one of the spiritual homes of the old Negro Leagues.
Absolutely.
You know, it's so anyhow, there I'm sure there'll be terrific ceremonies tonight in Kansas City. And the Jays will take on the Kansas City Royals. First pitch will be at 8 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet. Pregame on the TV side at 7:30 PM pregame with Rob Wong and Sho Ali right here in the radio station at 7 PM. We mentioned Austin Matthews is out of the Leafs lineup. I guess I'm going to call it a maintenance day.
Yeah, some kind of an arm thing, but nothing.
Yeah,
nothing too ominous. It sounds.
Well, the thing that they've been, that they've been monitoring for a while. But the focus in hockey right now, and rightly so, is what is going on with the Vancouver Canucks. We mentioned Elliot Friedman reporting that tomorrow's Oilers Canucks game has been postponed. John Shannon reporting the Leafs are still scheduled to fly to Vancouver tomorrow. For Saturday's game, the Canucks, they haven't played since, I think it's March 30th, and they have 21 players and four staff members who have come down with COVID-19. There were other family members as well. Those numbers not available to us. The Canucks back on the ice practicing today. The practice was closed to the media. There was a meeting or have been a series of meetings between medical groups, the Players Association, and the NHL. And the Canucks player. So as far as we know right now, Friday's game is canceled. Saturday's is still on, but clearly this is very much a day-to-day thing. Ren Lavoie is our NHL insider with TVS Sports, and he joins us on Writer's Block. Ren, thank you for doing this. We trust you're keeping well. Look, this is... this situation is... Boy, I mean, there were a lot of layers to it. We heard and saw JT Miller's interview yesterday, but... Something that Mr. Brunt and myself spoke about, you know, we're starting to hear now the possibility of interprovincial travel restrictions as well. I mean, who knows if that's going to happen? It's been talked about before.
Yeah.
Ren, are we ultimately, do you think, heading for a bubble situation for the Canadian division in the playoffs?
You know what? That's a big question mark still. I know the players don't want it. And I've talked to some players in the U.S., I asked them if there was any chance that they'll play in the bubble. The answer is a big no. But it's a different situation, obviously, between Canada and the U.S. If you look at the Pittsburgh Penguins, they're one of the last team in the league in the U.S. to get their vaccine. It was done. The first shot was done on Monday for the Pittsburgh Penguins. The next one is scheduled before the start of the playoffs. So, and in Canada, obviously, it's totally different, right? And because of that, you have to wonder if there'll be a bubble for the playoffs. I believe that will be the smartest thing to do because you don't want to have another situation like in Vancouver. But I'm telling you, there's a big pushback from the players right now when you're talking about a bubble. I guess there's always a way to find a solution, and it's the way you present it, I think, to the players. Because if you remember this last summer's bubble, it was way different than this year's bubble. You can go outside. You can have a run outside. Let's say the Canes or the Maple Leafs are playing in Vancouver. It's always beautiful weather, especially in the winter, compared to what we have here in the eastern part of the country. So you can go walk around, you can have a run outside. What you cannot do is go in a restaurant. If it's Tim Hortons or Starbucks, you're not allowed to go in, but you can still walk around. In last summer's bubble, there was no way you just can walk around the city. even if there was nobody downtown Edmonton, it was not allowed. So, I mean, that's why I believe that if the NHLPA is talking to the players and telling them, listen, we do believe that it will be way smarter to have one city where, you know, the first round is going to be played and the second round is going to be played. I think the players are going to really think about it and say, you know what, maybe this is the safest way to go on, because the last thing that you want is another situation like the Vancouver Canucks. If you have another situation like the Canucks during the playoffs, there's no more playoffs, right? Yeah. You have to shut everything down. So I guess the players are smart enough to understand that there's a big difference between last summer and this year. But you have to, when you're going to introduce that strategy to them, you need to do it the right way. You need to use another word than the bubble. That just the word bubble is scary for them. And I understand why. It wasn't fun last summer.
Yeah, and I get that, Ren. I have all kinds of, you know, I know people say they get paid a lot of money and they're playing a game. No, I get it. It would have been miserable, yeah. Right? But I guess the one thing I would think about now is, you know, it's only two rounds. Only two of the four teams are going to get to the second round. So it's going to be very limited. There's no fans, and there's not going to be any fans anyway. So, you know, and, you know, the fact what's happened in Vancouver, which came, you know, out of the community into the team, you know, that, you know, from a safety standpoint, again, as you say, none of these guys are going to be vaccinated. I would think if I was a player, if I was weighing everything there, I would say, you know, that's not that bad. Exactly. Considering now the other question that hangs in the air, maybe more than we thought it was going to, is what happens in the third round.
Well, that's easy to know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way. It's easy to say right now, there's no way that a team from the U.S. will come play here in Canada and vice versa. What I mean by that is you're not going to cross borders. I don't believe it's going to be feasible. I think logically it's possible, but I'm not sure that, you know, the federal government is going to give the green light to that. And you have to understand why. So what's next is going to be really interesting. But you know what? I don't think it's going to be a really big issue. If you have, if that Canadian team that's traveling to the U.S. Have maybe a chance to bring some family members in, and you're going to stay probably in the same city instead of, you know, the idea of putting the Toronto Maple Leafs in Buffalo, and after that, let's say you're playing the Boston Bruins or whoever, and the Bruins are playing their home games in Boston, and you're traveling to Buffalo to play the Toronto Maple Leafs. I don't understand why. I mean, even if Buffalo is close to Toronto, and, you know, it's impossible for Maple Leafs fans from Canada to cross the border to go see their team. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And why would you love to see players travel from one city to another? I'm not saying it's not safe, but it's not. There's no reason why you want to do that. So
you're saying you just go and play in the city. Yeah, even though I guess the only question would be, you know, again, the sense of home ice, any kind of a home ice advantage, because they will have a few fans probably wherever you're talking about in the States, right?
Yeah, but think about it. You know, there's not a lot of people in the stands. Probably somewhere in June, because we're talking here about the third round, so it's going to be somewhere in June, right? Probably there'll be more, and are we going to see full house? I'm not sure, but you know what? The players, when I know they like to have home ice advantage, okay, and I understand why, it makes sense, but especially because of the last change. But otherwise, the crowd, I'm not sure for them it's such a big difference. And at the same time, you know, I talked to Chris Letang yesterday from the Pittsburgh Penguins, and he was talking a little bit about the crowd, and it's getting louder. There's more and more people. He said, maybe it's going to be a good advantage for the team that's going to host, let's say, in the third round, the Toronto Maple Leafs. But what you need to think about what the league is going to really think about it, and how they're going to imagine the possibility of letting teams travel from one city to another in the third round. I don't know, but I'll be really careful. And at the end of the day, if you have the last change, I'm not sure. I'm not convinced that for the players, it's going to matter that much, to be honest with you.
Ren, one thing I'm not sure about either is Calgary and the Canadiens. Yeah. What now? Calgary trails Montreal by 4 points. The teams are going to play Friday.
Yeah.
Four times over the next 12 days. Why do the Flames have this edge over the Canadiens right now?
Hey, you're a baseball guy. I love baseball. You know, there's always somebody somewhere saying there's a book. You look at that pitcher and there's a book on that pitcher, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Or a goalie in the NHL. There's a book on that goalie. There's a book right now on the Canadiens. You're going to say, Renaud, there's a book on every team in the league. And I'm totally with you. It's a cliche, right? But it's a cliche right now that I like to use, because if you look at the beginning of the season, the Canadiens played their first game versus Toronto. Was a close game, was a really good game. After that, they played in Edmonton. Edmonton likes to play a run-and-gun type of game. It's nothing really physical, to be honest with you. They just want to, you know, skate around and try to see if they're going to win that game. They're not doing much physically. After that, you're playing the Vancouver Canucks, exactly the same situation. This is not a team who likes to be involved physically. They're not playing a in-your-face type of hockey. They just want to skate around, right? Then you have the Ottawa Senators of this world. Yes, sometimes they're really bad, but sometimes they're playing really good hockey. After that, you have the Calgary Flames. They're in your face. They're not giving you much. And it was the case before they made that coaching change. But now it's even, you know, it's tighter on the ice. Every time the Canadiens have the puck, there's somebody really close to you that there's no space. Actually, there's no space. The Winnipeg Jets, they played last week in Montreal, their first game. They won, but, you know, they played well in the first period. But after that, the Canadiens took advantage of them. Why? Because they were just skating around. And the Canadiens love to see another team just skating around, because they have a lot of talent and they're really quick. So what the Jets did for the second game on Saturday is they adjust. Talking to Mathieu Perreault after the game, he said, we decided to change our game plan to be more physical on them and to be in their face. So if you look around, there's a book on the Montreal Canadiens. It's not complicated. You just need to be in their face, and they just don't like it, Jets. That's the reality.
Well, and you know, and I think the Flames, like the overtime win over the Leafs was kind of a nothing game, so I don't put much stock in that. It was a nothing game both ways, right? And they, you know, but I thought seeing them playing the Habs, Ren, they look a little bit, you know, again, and this would be there would be an asterisk attached saying, you know, Markstrom's got to play well for him, but
yep.
They look like they're starting to kind of believe it, you know? And that would be, if I was a Habs fan, that'd be a little scary.
And rightly so, because it's not complicated. It's, you know, I was looking at one point during the game. They're just playing like the Jacques Lemaire system in the old days. Like there's a trap in a neutral zone. They're not giving you much. You have to dump the puck. If you're not quick enough to get it, you're not going to touch. You're not going to be capable of doing anything all night long. And that's exactly what happened last night. The Canadiens had one breakaway. They had a total of 6 scoring chances. Think about it. 6 scoring chances last night. That's the reality. And if they don't adjust, and adjusting is not complicated in my mind. Something that the Tampa Bay Lightning really did really well versus the Blue Jackets. Remember the Blue Jackets? They won versus the Toronto Maple Leafs in the bubble last summer. Mm-hmm. After that, it was not easy for the Lightning. But what one thing that the Lightning did is the D's were just flipping the puck in the neutral zone, and those forwards are so quick. That, you know, the Blue Jacket D's and forwards, they really need to adjust, because they were just running for that puck in the neutral zone. And sometimes you get lucky. And that's what happened with the Tampa Bay Lightning. They practiced that. They just used to flipping the puck maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 times during one period. It's working because everybody needs to push back. So that's one thing, if I'm the Montreal Canadiens, that I would love to see. Just flip the puck. You never know what's going to happen. And if you're doing that, even if you're not doing it every play, obviously the Ds, the forwards on the other side, they've got to think about what's next. And we don't want to get cut. So right now, I need to be careful here. But I think it's too easy to play versus the Montreal Canadiens. It's really, really sad to say. It's not something that I like to say. But you don't need to be a scientist to look at those games and say, oh, my God, you know, they're just unlucky and the bounces are not going their way. It's not true. They deserve to lose all these games. I'm sorry to say that.
Ren, what did you make of what the Leafs did at the deadline and what the Jets did or didn't do at the deadline? We'll see those two teams tonight.
Yeah, a little disappointed, to be honest with you, about the, about the Jets. I don't know. I think they need a defenseman that's capable of moving the puck a little bit. But you know what? They believe so much in Connor Hellebuck, and rightly so. I believe he's a Vezina winner probably again this year. Obviously, Vasilevsky with Tampa Bay is unbelievable again. And if you look at the way the Lightning are playing right now, they're not playing the right way. Let's put it that way. So I think it's going to be a really good battle. And I believe that they feel really good about their Ds, not because they're good really with the puck, but because they're really playing the right way. Mm. And I think there's something really unique right now with the Winnipeg Jets. The chemistry inside that room is quite special. If you look at Nick Foligno coming to the Maple Leafs, I think it's just great. It's about leadership. It's about playing the right way. He's not going to score a lot of goals between now and the start of the playoffs, but I believe that he's going to be capable of doing something important, with the Toronto Maple Leafs during the playoffs. And I think it was a really smart move to get a player like him. And it's going to pay off. I do believe it's going to pay off because even if, he's not a Stanley Cup winner, I think in a way he's playing like one. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. We'll see. But I think it's a really smart move.
Ren, thank you as always for doing this. Enjoy your weekend, my friend.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one. Take care.
Take care. That's Ren Lavoie, NHL insider with TVL Sports. And again, the Canucks game has been canceled tomorrow. As far as we know right now, the Leafs are still scheduled to fly to Vancouver from Winnipeg.
Yes, all TBD, though.
TBD. Are they in Winnipeg tonight, or are they here?
You know what? I don't know. I don't pay attention to where anybody is unless
they're flying. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Anyhow, they're... they were scheduled to fly to Vancouver to play the Canucks, but as Mr. Brunt says, I would imagine that everything right now is TBD. And this is, canceling tomorrow night's game, as I said, is almost a slam dunk. It would seem to have made just be smart to do it, given everything we've heard from JT Miller. But it buys the NHL time as well.
That's exactly
figure out where it's going.
Yeah, and again, nobody's in the wrong here. Like again, I wish I could say, wow, they absolutely should proceed along this path. Look, they're all making this up as they go along, right? But
yep.
But I do have to listen to the players. Again, even though everything has been collectively bargained and there is a system and the union's on side with that,
you do have to
listen to them as human beings right now, because again, we're in a place where, people are living through things they've never lived through before.
Yep. Jeff Passan is ESPN's MLB insider. It is Jackie Robinson Day in Major League Baseball. To celebrate, it looks like the White Sox and Indians had a fight. Of course, last night, the Carlos Rodon of the Chicago White Sox pitched a no-hitter. and hit a batter, Roberto Perez, with two outs left. Yeah. Otherwise, he would have had a perfect game. And, well, I mean, we're only a couple of weeks into the season, so I think it's still too much. I don't think the sample size is big enough to figure out whether or not the ball has had an impact on offense, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. But we do know that Major League Baseball is going to continue to experiment with its rules. We had Morgan Sword on a little earlier today. We'll talk to Jeff Passan about that. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. O'clock will be the first pitch tonight. Toronto Blue Jays, Kansas City Royals from Kansas City. 7 o'clock will be the radio pregame. 7:30, Blue Jays Central on Sportsnet. The first of four games between the Jays and the Kansas City Royals.
Do we have a Blue Jays starter yet or not?
I have not seen hide nor hair of a Blue Jays starter.
I just saw a Royals lineup, but I have not. Yeah.
You know, I got that itch that makes me think, I'm hoping it's not Tanner Roark, but I've got that rash.
I heard Bark talking about it in on Baseball Central. Like if you're going to let Tanner Roark pitch, that's maybe, like, is there a park that's bigger? like maybe if there's one.
Yellowstone Park.
If there's one bigger. But, anyhow. Yeah, maybe. Well, somebody's got to pitch.
I'm looking forward to this, but I mean, both Brent and I talked about this. The Kansas City Royals got my attention in spring training, and even though the major reason they got my attention in spring training isn't going to be playing today, there's enough of a residual glow from Bobby Witt Jr. that I will be paying attention tonight even more than I normally would.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Kansas City, let's bring in one of Kansas City's finest, I guess, Jeff Passan of ESPN. I can still call you that.
I mean, I hope so. I live here.
I don't
know if it's true.
I think it's true. It's America's finest city. It's one of America's finest cities.
Oh, if you want to call me one of America's finest, I'll take that. The Kansas City. That's you know.
So tell me, happy Jackie Robinson Day, by the way.
Is that something you wish happy? Sure.
Listen, we had Morgan Sword on, and Morgan Sword wished me a happy Jackie Robinson Day. So I've been going with it.
I'm sure Morgan did wish you a happy Jackie Robinson Day. I almost feel like that's like wishing someone like a happy Yom Kippur.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. All right. Okay. Jesus.
Yes, well, happy Good Friday. So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I try to be nice to people, you know, and this is the thanks I get. Okay, so, you know, if that's the way.
Hey, Jeff. Happy Jackie Robinson Day.
Yeah, okay. I was just trying to.
I think it's okay.
You're gonna work with me on it.
Yeah, I'll work with you on it. I think it's okay. I think we can celebrate. We are celebrating the life of Jackie Robinson, the life and legacy of Jackie Robinson.
Okay.
It is a celebration in that
All
sense.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah, I think
it's not a
it is.
Day of atonement or any of those things. It is a celebration.
Okay. Happy celebratory Jackie Robinson Day. And here I was going to go about Kansas City being the perfect place for it because of the Negro League Museum, spiritual home of. Negro Leagues, but I won't even bother going there. Spiritual home of Negro Leagues. I won't even bother going there because I'm gonna be.
Yeah, I feel like I put you on tilt with the Yom Kippur there.
Oh, well, you did. Yeah, I mean that's religion's a third rail in this show. Actually, it's a third rail in my life. Come to think of it, so.
Here's the thing. Anytime I can just get you off a little bit. Here's the thing. That's what you do with this show already.
Yeah,
you
I know.
You take the show off the rails professionally.
When someone else does it,
you're like, hey,
several people have pointed that out to me. I know between you and Samson's fun because what Samson will do is in the middle of an answer, he'll put in something really stupid just to see if you're paying attention. Or he'll end with something, you know, and then the fat brown cow went over the moon. And then he waits until you get any reaction. If he doesn't get a reaction from you, he goes, ha ha ha. Like that. So, I mean, anyhow, that's kind of where we are. Speaking of Morgan Sword, he basically confirmed to us, Passan, that they are not going to put a fourth base in between second and third as part of the rules, the rules things that they're dealing with in baseball. But
are you out on the rule changes?
No. Well, here's the thing. No, you know what? I was. I mean, when I first heard the double hook DH, I thought, oh Jesus, just another way my scorebook is going to get messed up.
We decided we liked it.
I mean, I'll just ask you this. 5 years down, 5 years down the road, what are we going to be watching? Hopefully, we'll be at a ballpark by that point in Toronto. What are we going to be watching when we go out to a game? When Brent and myself,
the robot Angel Hernandez. Yeah, you know, exactly. That's what it's going to be, the robot Angel Hernandez.
What are we going to be watching? How different is this game going to look?
I think it'll look different. I don't know if it'll look markedly different. I wonder if at that point there are going to be 7-inning games.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is the... I don't know if that's the logical end to all of this, because it would take something that is sacrosanct in baseball, which is the 9-inning game, and get rid of it. But I hate to say it, like, Pandora's box has been opened, fellas. Like, we have 7-inning doubleheaders now, and the games are no worse. I don't sit there during 7-inning baseball games and think, oh, my God, I'm being ripped off because I'm not getting this extra 2 innings. Mm-hmm. I mean, some players may say that come arbitration time when their statistics aren't quite the same as they were. And yet you could compare a 2-game season with, you know, a couple dozen 7-inning games to a full 154-game season. Yeah. And I bet you the number of plate appearances is pretty similar. Have we had a conversation, guys, about the thing I wrote about that I think is not a panacea entirely, but would solve a lot of baseball's problems?
What is that?
I think you could fix a bunch of what ails baseball by limiting pitching staffs to 10 or 11 pitchers.
Oh, I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Let me walk you through the argument here.
Okay.
One of the things that Major League Baseball has failed to do in recent years is create stars, right? And mm-hmm. I think one problem with creating stars is that only half of your population is capable of being a star. You have starting pitchers who go 5 and 6 innings now, and they are, by and large, at the apex of their profession. The notion of a complete game seemingly passed along with Roy Halladay. And the emphasis of the starting pitcher, I think, has been extremely problematic in a number of regards. So when you take away the ability to clown car a bullpen, you reemphasize the import of a starting pitcher and thus serve a couple of different purposes. Number one, your starting pitchers are all of a sudden stars again. They're not just guys who are going to 5 and fly on you. Number two, you have starting pitchers out there throwing more innings. And when they are throwing more innings, they can't go full tilt at all times. They can't go max effort at all times. They're going to need to learn to throw a sinker. They're going to need to learn to throw in the strike zone and not just waste pitches and not just go and try and spin every curveball at 3,000 RPM. When you have pitchers who are incentivized to stay in games longer and who are changing their arsenals in order to do that, the net result of that is going to be you're going to have much more hittable balls. You're going to have hitters who, you know, likelihood swing at pitches mm-hmm. earlier and who make more contact because of it. So it takes care of the pitching side and it takes care of the offensive side. You're not going to lose any jobs here. You're going to lose bullpen jobs. And what happens when you have a deeper bench and a deeper roster is that later in the game, you may have a guy like Terrence Gore on your roster who you wouldn't have been able to have when you went with 14 pitchers because right. there was no incentive to have a deep bench. Well, if you have a Terrence Gore or somebody who's a speedster on the roster, then you're going to have more pinch running opportunities. You're going to have more of a chance for exciting plays like stolen bases late in games. You're going to have much more aggressive managing early in games. Mm-hmm. You have more balls in play. You're going to have more stars being made by pitchers. Like I've yet to hear a really good counter argument as to why this is problematic. And I think the best would be, well, guys, if they're pitching more, are going to get hurt more, right?
Right.
The answer is no. Guys get hurt whether they pitch a lot or don't.
We haven't figured out how to stop arm injuries yet. If pitching less led to fewer arm injuries, then yeah, I'm on board with pitching less. But here's the reality, guys. It doesn't. So please, find me a flaw in this. Pick it apart for me. Tell me why this is not something that could work if you ease it in and transition over the next 5 to 10 years and let everybody in baseball understand that the end game is a 10 or 11-man pitching staff. So by the time you are in high school, you better start working like a starting pitcher and going deep into games and getting your arm to the point to be ready when you get into professional ball to go out there and throw 100 to 120 pitches every time you're out there and go 7 or 8 innings.
Yeah, you know, the thing, I like the idea personally. I mean, I think it's, you know, you can tinker with strategy and all this other stuff and pace of play, but ultimately I think you have to do something that forces people to manage a game differently and that forces teams to build themselves differently. I'm not certain the clock does that. Yeah, I'm not certain automated umpires do that. I think this is the answer to it. But, you know, the bottom line is like anything else, though, right? You're going to have to make an economic case to the Players Association. And I think
I think the economic case, Jeff, is very clear. You're going to be losing a bunch of $560,000 relievers, and you're going to be gaining a bunch of $560,000 position players.
Right.
The difference is that when you have a star starting pitcher, you look, whether it's Trevor Bauer making $40 million this year, Garrett Cole making 36 times 9, Zach Greinke at 35, you know, a good frontline starting pitcher is a mid-30s and higher per year guy. If you're trying to breed those in baseball, then hell yeah, your starting pitchers are going to get paid more, and it's going to be a better positive economically, I think, for the player side.
Yeah. No, look, I'm trying to come up with a counter-argument. I don't have one.
I have no counter-argument either.
A question about the here and now, and I acknowledging recency bias as part of this, because we've seen the Yankees 6 times already play the Jays. Do you think, can they be the Yankees team that most everybody assumed they would be this year, which is, you know, a 98-win team that wins the division and is a World Series contender, if Corey Kluber and Jameson Taillon are their 2 and 3 starters? Because I'll tell you something, Jeff, those guys, we've seen both of them now. Yeah, I know they're, you know, rebound candidates, you know, maybe Taillon's still on his way back, et cetera, but I didn't see a lot there.
Jeff, we're going to have to call you back. We dropped your line here.
Oh, did you?
Oh, no, it's there. It's okay. It's just that,
I'm here. I was just taking a breath and contemplating. I was trying to figure out what the right answer to this question is.
Sports Talk Radio. We don't want the right answer. We want the hottest take. We don't care about the right answer. We want the hottest take.
I gotta be honest, Stephen. I can't sit here right now and tell you that a guy coming back from Tommy John surgery and a guy coming back in Corey Kluber from a season-ending injury, two starts into the season, are not the solution. I think this is one of those. This is one of those where I feel like whenever I have a deal with a radio station for a weekly appearance going forward, I'm going to tell them that it's conditional on the hits not starting until May 1st.
Okay.
We sit here in April and we try and pick all of these things apart listen, I don't blame you. Like, that's our natural instinct, right? But the sample is just too small at this point to take away like clear, definitive things from that. That being said, Corey Kluber's stuff is not what it used to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Jameson Taillon, when he was at his apex, was sitting 95, and he's down about a mile and a half from that right now. But still, like a 94-mile-an-hour fastball and a slider at 88. It's not like he has incredibly diminished stuff.
remember, he's coming back from a second Tommy John surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the touch and feel and command especially takes time. So can they win with them as the 2-3 starter? Yes. Yes, they can. Can they win with them as the 2-3 starters looking like they have so far? That's going to be a lot more difficult for them to do.
Well,
that being said, if there's anybody, I think Jacob deGrom's the best pitcher in the world.
Yep.
But I think if you want someone to go out and pitch games 1, 4, and 7 of a series, it's probably Gerrit Cole.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he is. I feel like he is built for that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, no, No, yeah. I got no arguments about one. I guess what I'm saying is though that it seems like. And again, maybe this is, you know, the 2021 version of the New York Yankees and their, you know, and the organization and their payroll, et cetera. You know, and again, not like they don't spend, but they don't spend like they used to spend. That 40% of their starting pitchers are, you know, rebound candidates, right? That just doesn't seem like a Yankees thing to me somehow. That you know, that sounds more like,
yeah.
You know, like a lot of places where you go, well, we hope he gets back to what he was. That's a lot of hope, 40% of your starting rotation.
It is, and beyond that, I mean, you know, Jordan Montgomery and like Domingo Herman, who I think just got demoted as well.
Yeah.
Like, that being said, Chapman's looked really good. Loaisiga has looked fantastic. Darren O'Day's been really good. Chad Green's really good. Michael King had that excellent relief appearance. Even like. Luis Sessa has been solid. Albert Abreu has big stuff. Like, they got enough arms.
Yeah.
And I like, my concern with the Yankees is as much about, like, Gleyber Torres at shortstop and Luke Voit's health and Aaron Judge staying healthy all season. And why has Aaron Hicks looked like he can't hit? Mm-hmm. And I think the starting pitching there is probably going to work itself out. It might not be dominant, but let me ask you this. Who in the American League does have a good rotation?
Mm.
Like, whose rotation do you look at and say, now, those guys are good? Chicago White Sox? Yeah, they've got, you know, Giolito, who's been awesome so far, and had a no-hitter from Carlos Rodon last night, and he's sort of a back-end guy. Lance Lynn's been really good. I mean, the White Sox have a lot of arms. I just don't know that if you look around the American League at all, there are teams that have really good rotations.
Now, a couple of years down the road, you might be talking Kansas City and Toronto, but I think you're right. There are some issues.
Yeah.
There are some issues right now with almost every team. Mr. Passan, thank you for doing this as always. Happy Jackie Robinson Day.
Thank you so much. Sean, it's over to you too, Mr. Blair.
Take care. That's Jeff Pass at ESPN's senior baseball writer, MLB Insider.
Yes, indeed.
That was Happy Jackie Robinson Day.
Yeah.
Today's a happy day, and it's Jackie Robinson Day. Ergo, like, I'm happy today. So, ergo, it's Jackie Robinson. Happy Jackie Robinson Day.
Happy Blair. Happy Jackie Robinson Day.
Tim and friends are next. We'll get you set for it. Don't go anywhere. All right, we're going to hand it over to our friends at Tim and Friends. You're not a friend today, are you, Brunt?
I'm always a friend.
You're always a friend, but you're not an official friend.
I'm not a professional friend.
Not a professional friend. All right. I know one of the things they've hammered this in social media. That's kind of cool, actually. The pick, of course, you know, Carlos Rodon pitched a no-hitter last night.
Yes, and nearly a perfect
game. Nearly a perfect game. Hit Roberto Perez with a pitch on the front of his left foot, or in his left foot, I should say, his front foot, with one out. And of course, Rodon goes to first base, and then you got the game. No, it's not a perfect game; it's a no hitter instead. The Tim and Sid folks are Tim and Sid folks. Just seriously, just take me out in the back right now and right in the head. Anyhow, the Tim and Friends folks,
them
have asked whether or not, it's a good question, whether or not Roberto Perez should have gotten out of the way. Now, there was some conversation between Rodon and Perez as Perez went down to first base. And we'll say this first of all. The pitch hit him. There's no doubt that the pitch hit him.
Yes, it did.
It hit him on his lead foot.
Mm-hmm.
So it was going to be a ball.
Yep.
So, unwritten rules thing, Mr. Brunt. Yeah. Do you shuffle out of the way to let the ball bounce in the dirt?
On your lead foot? When you're still up there taking a competitive, you know, you're not trying to facilitate. Yeah, I know. But, like, you know, it's not like the one the other night with the lean in with the elbow.
Yeah, no, that was.
Right?
Yeah.
Like with the armor.
Except that won a game.
That did win a game. But, and if the umpire chooses not to, you know, to allow it, that's the only, you know, the rules are written in a certain way, but it's essentially it's in the umpire's
like
head. Right?
When I first saw the play last night and I saw the back and forth, I kind of got the impression that it was Rodon kind of having a chuckle about, you know, that what a way to lose the perfect game, that type of thing. And I didn't think of it because I watched the game as it was happening. I go, oh, geez, he got hit by a pitch. And it does happen in perfect games. We've seen perfect games broken up like that.
Yep.
Then the more I looked at it when I got in the office today, I thought, I don't know if that's like unwritten rule territory. Like bunting in a perfect game.
Yeah, that was, you know, that's obvious. You know, as you said, it's an 8-0 game. But I like, again, if it's a legit hit by pitch, mm-hmm. right? Like that would be.
It was inside.
So it's not a guy attempting to be hit. And it's not a guy looking at a 71-mile-an-hour curveball and, you know, counting off the seconds as it comes
he
in.
He did nothing other but hold his position at the plate.
Yeah.
He held his position.
I'm not sure. Look, I would have loved to have seen a perfect game too. You know, they don't happen. That's an astounding accomplishment. 27 up, 27 down, right? But I'm not sure I can argue with it, Jeff.
Okay. Like, yeah, no, like, I think it's a fair question for them to ask. I just, it got me thinking. In the break, I went and looked and said, geez, they're asking a question. I mean, I didn't even ask Barker about it. I don't know. Now that I think about it, like if I'm Roberto Perez, I'm not moving.
No, I don't think so.
But could I see other players being critical of him for not moving?
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah, it's just that we've seen such an egregious one.
Right.
You know, we've seen, like, we know what that looks like.
Yes.
A guy, you know.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
I don't think it's so if it's kind of in the normal course of a ball game. Yeah. It would have been great if he'd done it and allowed the perfect game.
Yeah.
But I can't hold it against him.
And then, of course, if that happens, we're asking Roberto Perez, did you move your foot out of the way so he'd get a perfect game?
Yeah, that's a new, except no one would remember that.
Mm. Blue Jays baseball at 8 o'clock tonight. Don't miss it. It's Kansas City Royals. They're a lot of fun. No indication yet as to who the Jays starting pitcher is. We do know Anthony Kaye traveled with the team. Tim and friends are next. Have a great night.